Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/tripcast. Over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player.
Texas Talking. Oh, what was that you said? Texas Talking.
Hey everybody, this is Matt Largie, the news editor over at KUT. Why do I listen to the Tribcast?
Insert poorly written joke criticizing the Tribcast.
I kid. Everybody knows the Tribcast.
Pretend to say something nice about the Tribcast in hopes of getting tickets to this year's Tribune Festival.
And now, your Tribcast crew.
Thank you. This is reporter Reeve Hamilton here with the Tribcast for the second week of March. Joining me is editor-in-chief and CEO Evan Smith.
Hey, dude.
Hey.
it's South by.
Yeah.
You know.
I thought we had a much more formal relationship.
There's really no hipping up this podcast. I shouldn't have tried.
Editor Emily Ramshaw is also here.
Hey, bro.
Now, see, that I'm used to.
I'm a big fan of the longer Brocephus or Broham.
Speaking of.
Broseph.
Ben Philpott of KUT in the Texas Tribune.
I don't understand why I had to pay for a badge to get into the podcast.
Ben is the kid that the hip kids beat up.
If you lose that podcast badge, it's like $1,500.
Damn
it. Ben's an aspiring hipster. Look at his glasses.
For those of you that,
Ben, yeah, yes, it's always good to aspire to something, Ben. Too bad.
For those of you that are listening and aren't in Austin, A, you can't see Ben's glasses, but they're very hipster.
They're kind of like Evans.
Terrific. Yeah, and so are Evans. And I guess B, you should know that South by Southwest is going on, and we're just surrounded by dirty people.
And C, 15 minutes into this podcast, there's going to be a free Muse show, actually, is going to just break out here in the multimedia lounge.
You should see how excited Ross Ramsey gets when the party bus drives by our window. It's like the double-decker one with all the, you know, people.
But that has nothing to do with South by Southwest.
Ross, right. For a really, really, really old guy, Ross is actually quite interested in seeing music live. I am totally tired of it myself.
Well, no, the thing is, Ross is only like 28, but he's just seen so much music live. It's really worn him out.
Rode hard and put up wet, as they say. Is that it? Right?
Plus, when you have like Wilco in your living room, like Evan does, you don't really have to go see live music.
Don't tell. People are going to want to come over.
Basement. Basement is the word you're looking for.
Chained up.
All right, let's move on.
Exactly.
So we can.
Exactly.
We can transition.
Shut up, Jeff Tweedy. I'll feed you later.
What were we going to talk about? This is a disaster. We can transition musically, though. One of the big headlines of the week so far is that in his announcement for Land Commissioner, George P. Bush opted to soundtrack that with the Beyonce song.
Does he have to ask her permission?
I don't know.
It was I do want to hear the actual answer. She's a Democrat.
I do want an actual answer on that.
She has supported Barack Obama a little bit in the past.
It's an instrumental version.
Just a little bit. But
so the instrument, the
you
kind
know,
of
George
the real,
P, Jay-Z, what's the difference?
Kind of the real the answer on that is, you know, he went through some kind of ad agency to create this. The ad agencies have, you know, buy licenses to be able to use instrumental versions of different songs. And obviously he would use an instrumental because you don't want people singing along with her in the background while he's trying to tell them to give him money.
Well, also we know that Beyonce can only lip sync, so.
Oh, I thought that was Taylor Swift.
No, she sang and they played a backing track at the same time. It's not exactly the same thing. But let's not get off topic.
Too late.
Yeah. Yes, Reeve, we wouldn't want to get off topic.
Do we make anything of the content of the song is really about sort of recognizing someone as sort of your angelic hero while everything falls apart, which I guess is consistent with what George Bush is trying to be.
His Ganny, as he said in the video, is his grandmother, Barbara Bush. She would be his angelic hero in this case. Look, I think that the significant part of this, of course, is we now know what his intentions are. And I got to tell you, the first opportunity I have to interview George P. Bush, my question is going to be, Land Commissioner? Really?
I think he's aiming too low, considering what I think he could do, right?
Well, but of course, we'd be let's say that we and others would be criticizing him if he started at the top.
He has no political experience.
You've done nothing. How can you run for governor?
Ted Cruz just prove that was totally doable?
But Ted Cruz had done a significant amount in public life previously. Ted Cruz had absolutely—I would submit Ted Cruz's resume running up to that race was perfectly appropriate for a race at that point. The thing about George P. is he has not. You're correct.
George P. spent years growing up in the Bush family.
You know, that and 50 cents will get you a Coke, right? I mean, that's not...
I think growing up in the Bush family will get you a lot more than a Coke.
You can get at least 75 cents.
But politically these days, I'm not certain
maybe
that being
a
Bush... Look, this is a very important part of this conversation, and I think it's going to have a lot to do with how he's viewed. And it's already having a lot to do with how he's being viewed by the likes of Michael Quinn Sullivan, who was not entirely enthusiastic yesterday in sort of representing his flock of people, that side of the conservative spectrum. George P. Bush has not proved himself yet in the eyes of conservatives, despite having endorsed Ted Cruz when Ted Cruz was at 2% in that Senate race. George P. does not have Tea Party bona fides to the extent that the conservatives are willing to say, okay, it's a coronation, we're done.
I thought what was fascinating about what Michael Quinn Sullivan said on Twitter yesterday, you know, I'm always expecting from him a strong opinion one way or the other. And his, I think what he tweeted was, okay, folks out there, you know, I don't know that much about George P. Bush, you know, tell me what you think. Which I thought was really interesting because there's probably that sentiment happening a lot right now. People just really don't even know enough about him to make any kind of judgment call.
Well, what they know about him is that he is the so-called little brown one his grandfather talked about back when he was president, his grandson. They know nothing else about him. And when you listen to that video and he talks about his life, the fact that he's been a naval reservist for some time, you know, that's a good resume line. Mm-hmm. There's a lot about his resume that is actually just fine as a candidate. If it were not, if he were George P. Schwartz or somebody as opposed to George P. Bush, you would still think, well, that's pretty good.
But if he were George P. Schwartz and he had announced for land commissioner, we would not be talking about him today.
Look, the thing is, this state...
Well, maybe... And he would not be viewed as the inevitable winner of that primary
election,
which he is now.
Well, it depends on how much of the rest of his resume stayed the same. Because, he, you know, he is also one of the co-chair founders of the Hispanic Republicans of Texas, this group that's trying to, you know, create some room for Hispanic representation.
Recently.
Yeah, about 2 years ago.
Right, and if you judge them by their success in getting Hispanic Republicans elected to the legislature, they've taken a step back from 2010 to 2012 in that they went from, I think, 6 in the legislature last session to 3 Hispanic Republicans this session, including one who was made to switch parties because it was an inevitable outcome for him. If he didn't switch, he'd probably lose. I just don't know. I mean, I'm at a loss to know what to make of his candidacy without getting to hear from him on the issues that are specific to the land office.
I think you could make the land office what you want it to be. I mean, I think, you know, these are roles, agriculture commissioner, land commissioner in the past, that Texans have used as huge launching pads to statewide office, bigger statewide office, yeah. Obviously. I don't know. I think, you know, there's an opportunity to sort of take what sounds like sort of an archaic job and turn it into something that, you know, really looks deep into immigration issues in Texas. And I don't know. I think that there's a possibility that that could feel like a bigger job than under somebody else than it does.
He mentions this in his video announcing that the land office really does touch a lot of different areas. Uh-huh. You know, it's involved in Veterans Affairs. It has access to, like, key pots of money for both public ed and higher ed. Control over coastal
yeah. erosion and essentially that whole portfolio of issues.
But we had heard, I mean, I think we had heard that he was
Veterans Land Board is kind of...
this could be a great training ground, frankly, for getting up to speed on Texas.
I think we had heard that he was considering higher or more...
Well, we heard he was
office.
Considering the Attorney General's office. Somebody pointed out that he's inactive. He has an active status within the state bar. I don't know if that's true or not, but he certainly has not been out there practicing law. Mm-hmm. He's not been litigating and sort of doing the kind of things that you would want to, you know, show that I'm ready to be AG.
I mean, is this filing pretty much a done deal? You know,
do we know anyone else who's running against him?
Could he switch gears and jump into a different race?
It is a done deal. I don't think he switches gears and gets in another race. And we don't yet know anybody who's running against him. There was some discussion about, you know, Hager running for comptroller, Hildebrand running maybe for ag commissioner. Deborah Medina's been talking about running for comptroller. I mean, I think there are a lot of different people considering a lot of different down-ballot offices, and something that was pointed out by Pete Gallego this morning on the Daily Rundown, the Chuck Todd program on MSNBC, is that back in, and undeniably correct, that back in 1990, the way that Rick Perry and Kay Bailey Hutchison got into office and became the two most powerful Republicans for a long period of time there was by running for ag commissioner and state treasurer, you know, very much down-ballot, mid-level offices. It was supposed to be that election cycle. Governor Clady Williams and Lieutenant Governor Rob Mosbacher, they both lost, but Rick and Kay won, and then they became really important to the overall conversation in politics for the next 20 years. So if he runs for a down-ballot office and he gets elected, it most definitely can be a stepping stone over time. Plus, he's young. He's under 40.
Yeah.
Right? He's got plenty of time to develop a profile politically in this state.
I don't think this is a bad move. And I don't think it's necessarily an unimportant, you know, move. Everybody who's saying that he should have, you know, taken a bigger risk or tried for a bigger slot. I mean, maybe this is the right place.
What about the whole idea of what the Tea Party or the Republican primary voter thinks of him? You know, he's a Bush, which the Tea Party isn't very happy about, but then he did adopt Ted Cruz early there.
Well, what he has going for him in some order is, A, he's Hispanic at a time when the Republicans are trying to get prominent Hispanic candidates to run.
But that doesn't mean that the Tea Party wing necessarily appreciates
B,
that.
B, he has an Anglo surname, and C, he has that Anglo surname, right? I mean, and if you look at the Xavier Rodriguez and Victor Creo issues, right. You know, they were both beaten by relative unknowns who had Anglo surnames in the primary. And, you know, Bush benefits from, on the one hand, being Hispanic, on the other hand, having a surname that is not
Hispanic,
outwardly seeming Hispanic. And then it also is this particular surname, the old Bush network, which, you know, kind of hilariously is the K network. The old Bush network will be marshaled for his benefit, I think, fundraising and otherwise. And, you know, his dad will come here and campaign. I suspect we'll see the return of the president. President Bush into Texas politics, dip his toe in to support his nephew.
I think he's largely a shoo-in.
You got to think he's a shoo-in. And the Democrats will, you know, the Democrats are already sort of picking at him from the left. Oh, you know, he's dilettante and he's just a, he's a granddaddy's boy. And, well,
yeah, but who are they going to put up to run against?
I think what Progress Texas put out was in their press release was George Bush's nephew runs for land commissioner.
They want to basically hang George right. Bush around his neck.
They, said that his basically the legacy of No Child Left Behind, all this stuff, is like a shadowing over George P. Bush. And I don't know if people really draw that connection as strongly in terms of policy.
I can't see how George P. Bush can be made to answer for his uncle.
Oh, that's too far removed.
You know, have you met some of my uncles? I wouldn't want to have to answer for them either. I mean, you got to be kidding me. You don't have to answer for your uncle.
I think
that's
people,
crazy.
Readers of the Tribune will notice that Evan's uncles are rarely mentioned.
We don't talk about them. Yeah. I've got a rule against mentioning my uncles.
Do you even have uncles?
I have uncles.
Oh. He has uncles.
They're
a
good
monkey's
uncles.
Uncle.
Well, before we leave the sort of horse race thing and move into more policy issues, we should remind folks that we are sponsored by Audible.com, which is a wonderful source of audiobooks. And you can get a free 30-day trial and a free audiobook if you go to audibletrial.com/Tribcast. And Evan, what should they download if they do that?
I'm just enjoying watching you do commerce. This is
I know,
hilarious.
It's amazing. We've really moved over.
It's honestly not something I'm used to, given my salary.
Zing. When will selfpity.com become a sponsor of this podcast?
He already owns that.
Yeah.
The last audiobook that I downloaded was Larry Wright's book about Scientology.
Oh, I'm reading that right now.
Oh, that's a great book.
It's a great book to listen to, and the
who I narrates think that, it?
Just some guy. I mean,
too
it's
bad
not,
Larry doesn't.
Tom Cruise. Yeah.
John Travolta. Yeah.
They take turns.
Yeah.
No, it's sure. It's a really
then
good book.
Then L. Ron Hubbard redacted.
It's a great book. It's and I actually find driving long distances, which one is prone to do in the state of Texas, I'd rather listen to an audiobook than pretty much anything.
NPR.
Is this sponsored content?
Yes.
Not sponsored content. I mean, I actually do own that book. I can prove
no, that. Yeah. That is, I will vouch for that book if you don't trust Evan.
It's a great book.
Yeah. All right, now let's move on. Thank you. audibletrial.com/Tribcast. You can get that book for free or a different book if you want. But let's talk about Medicaid.
That was
Are we expanding?
Good transition.
What are the chances of expanding Medicaid?
Is this sponsored content?
I don't know, Evan. You're the one raising all the money for us. you know, I think where we are, first of all, I think this is, we've been told that we should all be listening to Rick Perry's speech on Thursday at CPAC in D.C. We've been told that he's going to make some of his sort of strongest comments yet on what the future of Medicaid might look like in Texas.
He's got stronger ones
How
than what he's already said.
How much stronger can he get than
so
not just no, but hell no?
Well, I think maybe stronger is the wrong word.
More nuanced.
Yes, good read.
Jinx.
Good one. So I think, you know, what we've seen over the last couple of weeks is clearly Republican lawmakers sort of shifting in this direction of, well, let's start having a conversation about how to reform Medicaid, and maybe in that process we can also negotiate a way to expand Medicaid. So I think increasingly we're hearing from Republican lawmakers that this divide, you know, that we thought was there is maybe not going to be there, that they are really, you know, sort of open to negotiating with the Obama administration if Texas can get some kind of a Medicaid expansion on Texas's terms. You know, we've seen the Obama administration being quite open to negotiating with all these other states, whether it's Arkansas or Florida, although Florida may be falling apart because the legislature...
Well, the Florida Senate doesn't like what Rick Scott did, but right. the jury's still out on what's going to ultimately happen.
Right. Right. So, you know, I think Perry has maintained that, you know, Texas will not expand Medicaid. This has been his strong stance. I think you're going to see this drum that's continuing to be beaten by some members of the Republican Party that are saying, you know, look, this is way too much money to pass up. We have to figure out some kind of way to negotiate this. So John Zerwas, Representative John Zerwas, Republican of Simonton, he's an anesthesiologist. He's, you know, one of the legislature's sort of strongest health care proponents on the Republican side.
And a real conservative, mm-hmm. right? He's not a fake
conservative. As opposed to?
Well, the point is, I don't think that whatever you attack Zerwas
name
for,
names?
Yeah. Historically, Zerwas has not been attacked for being a fake conservative. He's right on all the issues from the conservative perspective.
Right. And he filed a bill right sort of under the filing deadline, basically that would direct the legislature to negotiate with the federal government to try to find some kind of solution. So that a lot of folks were wondering whether that bill was going to get filed or whether any kind of negotiation was going to have to be tacked onto the budget as a rider at the end. So that measure has been filed. Again, we'll see how far it goes.
And in fact, the speaker a couple days before had telegraphed to Peggy Feacock of the Express mm-hmm. News, not necessarily an openness to challenge the governor's stated position on this, but at least he said, look, we got to figure this out.
Right.
He was not sort of making the hell no argument that the governor was making.
Right.
Well, making the argument that let's have something in place in case.
Or it's less of an in case and more of a directing the legislature, directing Health and Human Services to start figuring out whether there is a way to negotiate.
So, but what do we think that we're going to get that we don't already have? I mean, the Arkansas and the Florida agreements essentially are things, I've been told, essentially are things that Texas already has. So what are we asking for beyond that?
What Arkansas is doing, I don't think, is something that Texas already has. And what, you know, what Arkansas has been offered is effectively being given that funding to, you know, help people buy into the private market.
But I thought we already had managed care system with Medicaid.
Managed care is what Florida is more the Florida approach.
Oh, okay.
So, and, you know, Texas already does have managed care, but it's for Medicaid. So I think, you know, what we're looking at, look, there are a whole range of possibilities, but a lot of Republicans have said that the Arkansas plan is something that Texas, you know, that's really private market based. The insurance companies would love it.
Right.
So I think you're seeing a little bit of push toward the Arkansas plan.
So, but what is, you know, you were talking earlier, Evan, about breaks in the dam and are they actual breaks or not? I mean, if Governor Perry comes out on Thursday and, you know, lays down his opinion on this again in the negative and talks about all the horrible things about Medicaid, and then we've got senators like Senator Estes had a op-ed a day or so ago on this. I mean, you still have Republicans that are saying forget it, and of course the biggest one being the governor. How do you push back against that?
What there is not is unanimity of opinion mm-hmm. on this. I think that you're seeing some Republicans say grudgingly, look, it's the law of the land, Roberts Court upheld it. Election's over. It's going to be, you know, Ted Cruz and John Cornyn attempting to defund Obamacare, notwithstanding, it ain't going to happen. Because even if a bill could get out of the Senate, which it can't, and would get out of the House, the president would veto it. But of course, the same could be said here.
Even
if the legislature did something that gave a little ground on this, the governor could veto it, and that would be the end of it. I always see a hidden motivation in all this sort of stuff, and I don't suggest that the governor is not sincere in his opposition to the principles at work here, but I also think that politically for him, this is the right decision to make in that if, in fact, he's going to run for president in 2016 and he's watching Jeb Bush and Paul Ryan and Marco Rubio and Chris Christie go all squishy on certain issues that are of you know, kind of conservative hallmark issues,
right.
He gets to be the one who stands out on the edge and say, all of y'all compromise with the president. All of y'all compromise with the administration. You gave in on core conservative principles. I'm the only one who wouldn't. For him, standing on ceremony has a political benefit.
He may also be trying to get the absolute best deal possible for Texas,
right.
And the longer he holds out, the better deal he might get. I mean,
but
he
his
said,
leverage diminishes, I think, with each day that another state, with another red state. Well, because
the
whole thought
so.
Was, but Emily, the whole thought, what I thought, this could be incorrect, that Texas viewed itself as part of a group of states whose combined population was so large that if they resisted compromising with the administration, mm-hmm. the cost savings that were built into the ACA simply would not – could make it work without those populations. Texas is kind of the outlier right now. Texas likes to be the outlier on all things.
But it also has the biggest population of the uninsured. I mean, getting Texas –
now it's 28.8 million, according to that last study.
Wait, uninsured?
28.8%.
Yes, the Gallup.
6.2 million.
28.8 million would be more people than we have in the state.
28.8%. 28.8% of the population.
And 2 million of those people who might be eligible for coverage under a Medicaid expansion. So that's
or more. Steve Murdoch, I think, even put it at 3 million.
Right. So it's an exorbitant number of people. I think, you know, Perry maybe just sort of seeing how long he can hold out. Look, Perry's repeatedly said, we want the federal government to give us a block grant to run Medicaid.
That big fabled cartoon bag of money with a dollar sign on
but
it.
Guess,
just drop it on our doorstep.
But guess what? I mean, that's looking less and less like a complete and utter pipe dream than it used to. Again, what they've done, what they're doing with Arkansas is really phenomenally, you know, different than what they've done with other states in the past. He may not be, you know, I mean, he may be holding out hope that there may be some deal that approaches it, or else that he could bill as a block grant for a Medicaid expansion as opposed to. So,
isn't this what we've said, sort of all we, the Tribcast people, all along, just sort of, you know, stake out this very hardline position, but in the back rooms, actually be talking and figure things out. We say this on a number of things.
I mean, I think the question is who's doing the negotiating? And, you know, at this point, it's sort of unclear if someone other than, say, Billy Hamilton, you know, is writing some big proposal.
Well, and Billy Hamilton's position is explained, I think, yesterday or the day before, is this is the best deal that I've seen in 30 years of state government. We ought to take it. Billy Hamilton is
He appears to be
expansion.
The only one publicly doing any real.
Billy Hamilton is the former longtime revenue estimator in the comptroller's office who has been viewed up until this point where, if you disagree with me, you're a partisan. Mm-hmm. He was viewed as an honest broker. Everybody, both sides viewed him as an honest broker. Problem is, these days, if you say something different from what I believe, now suddenly you're a communist.
Right.
We should do a TT interview with Billy Hamilton.
We should. I mean, in the same way that the LBB used to be viewed as an honest broker until it started to disagree with people in power, and now suddenly it's some communist plot.
So we call dibs on that interview if anyone's listening.
Right.
Exactly. Bob Garrett, stand down.
Right. Well, I just wonder, though, to your point, Evan, about, you know, he's trying to make some grand stand for if he's going to run for president later on.
I just think it has the benefit of that, whether that's the principal motivation or that's an ancillary motivation. I think it has that benefit.
Well, I just wonder, though, I mean, to me, that means that he has to be a no forever, and he has to veto it, and he has, because he, you know, what we learned in the last election was standing behind, the majority of the legislature wanted to do it, doesn't protect
him. Cracks in the dam doesn't mean that the dam breaks. I'm not suggesting that. I actually think that if I'm a betting man right now, we don't end up making a deal with the federal government. I think we don't.
Boy, it's a lot of people and a lot of money.
And, you know, Becca had a fantastic, Emily. Becca had a fantastic interactive a couple weeks ago in which she broke down by legislative district.
I know. I edited it.
Well, it was great. I'm indirectly giving you mad props for that. That it was a fantastic interactive that showed by legislative district, by House district, by Senate district, how much money was at stake in the expansion.
And these are all Billy Hamilton's analysis.
But it's, you know, you go into a district that is red as can be, and you say you're looking at, you know, a couple $200-300 million. You're looking at uncompensated care costs in the 60s or 70 millions, and you're going to knock that down not entirely to zero, but to a. I mean, that to walk away from that money is a tough thing.
Well,
the people of your district it's a tough thing.
Which is why the cracks are forming, because you've got hospital groups and doctors groups behind the scenes just beating up on suburban Republicans and rural Republicans on this.
Now, I will say 2 years ago, around this time, John Zerwas, the one who's filed this Medicaid expansion, keeping the door open, he filed the bill for a health insurance exchange, which is another part of the Affordable Care Act that basically an orbit-style exchange to invite people into the private market.
And that went nowhere.
So just because he may be sort of the leading healthcare thinker on the Republican side doesn't mean that this measure of his is
going to go
anywhere.
I just think it's significant that it was Zerwas and not, you know,
Lon Burnham,
some moderate creep.
Who's a moderate creep?
Why would you put those words together?
Well, I mean, I'm not my point of view, but you know how anybody who proposed such a thing who was a more moderate Republican would be attacked.
Are you the Ted Cruz campaign?
Yes.
I think the word you
know whether the moderate creeps got money from a foreign government.
Evan Quinn Sullivan over here.
The word you're looking for is communist. I think.
Yeah.
Some communist.
No, I'm gonna stay with creep.
Moderate creep.
Yeah.
Let's move.
Communist creep.
I really can't think of a good transition, but let's just move to my issues.
The rest of us are going to leave the room now.
Some people are interested in the University of Texas System Board of Regents. And what's interesting about that fight is, you know, there's been this fight between sort of the tension between the system and UT Austin, and a lot of that is focused on the new Joint Oversight Committee in the legislature, which is basically set up to look into their problems. It's like a relationship counselor for the system and the university. But really, a lot of the action looks like it might be in this Select Committee on Transparency and State Operations, which is going on in the House. And they had their first meeting on the UT Law School and Law School Foundation issue this week. And it was interesting. It was also interesting in sort of who wasn't there and
who wasn't there.
Well, the UT system wasn't there. So there's there's this issue where in 2011, the dean of the UT Law School was fired, and it sort of was revealed that the Law School Foundation, which is the separate nonprofit money raiser for the law school, had this forgivable loan program, and he had gotten $500,000 from it.
Larry Sager, the old dean.
Right. And so there's been all these issues about, was that not transparent enough? Was that proper? And the UT system did a long report looking into it, which took about a year to complete. And then after they did the report, they decided to form a task force to look into it some more.
And one controversy, Reeve, that came up out of this was that Bill Powers, when he had been dean of the law school, now president of the university, had himself gotten a forgivable loan. And there was concern, at least rumored concern, that the report was not hard enough.
Bill Powers didn't get a forgivable loan, but the program did start under his watch.
So hold it. So there's not...
Well, this is one of the issues.
Was there not a? I'll take that back, of course, right here. But I thought that there had been. I thought that Powers had gotten a forgivable loan.
He had gotten. I think he had gotten loans the best. He did not get a forgivable loan under the forgivable loan program, but he started it.
He started it. So that was the controversy.
The program started under him.
But I thought that the controversy over the report, which the Statesman reported this weekend, the general counsel, Barry Bergdorf, am I correct about this, when he left the system, there was some sense that there was a relationship between his departure and unhappiness over that report.
I mean, you could also say that I reported that before they did, but that's fine.
Another story I edited.
Yeah. The the talk around the system has been that Bergdorf, who is the general counsel, outgoing general counsel for the UT system, was commissioned to do this report looking into the relationship between the law school and the Law School Foundation. He completed the report in about May, and the regents wouldn't accept the report until it went back further and looked at Bill Powers' tenure.
As dean.
So Bergdorf went back, and he finally came back with a final report in November, and that report basically said that Bill Powers had done everything right. So
they denied that report existed?
No. So the feeling is that, you know, if you are one of these people that believes that their UT regents are out to get Powers, this is the prime example, right? They will not rest until this investigation has something to hang Powers on. I don't know if that's fair or not, but that's sort of the framing among certain people that have been following the life of this report. And so that was one of the issues. Trey Martinez Fisher, who had to step out for most of yesterday's hearing about the Law School Foundation that was going on at the legislature, and they had the board president of the foundation and the UT Law School.
John Massey, who's the president of the board, and Ward Farnsworth, who's the dean
of the law school. They were both there, but Brenda Pavich, who's a regent who is running this task force to continue to look into this issue at the system, was not there. And Trey Martinez Fisher afterwards was like, look, the system has spent tons of human capital and time and money investigating this issue. They have a final report. What is so compelling about this issue that they are continuing to look into it, and he really wants the system to be involved in dialogue, so we might have to redo that whole hearing. But this is really like where a lot of this tension has focused and is really happening in this committee, not the Joint Oversight Committee, which is having its first hearing next week, March 19th.
Well, sort of to put this in sort of the global perspective, you know, the legislature, lawmakers are increasingly looking at foundations like these and the role that these sort of these affiliated foundations play in augmenting the salaries of individuals. I mean, the other place that this committee is really going to look is with CPRIT, the Cancer Prevention and Research Institute of Texas, that's come under a lot of fire. And there's also been a lot of concern about this affiliated CPRIT foundation, you know, that was supplementing the salaries of these researchers that lawmakers were, or that that the agency was trying to bring to Texas. So there's a lot of sort of discussion right now around how these foundations operate, you know, who's shedding light on them, where the contributions for these foundations are coming from, and who the money is then in turn going to. This is an interesting sort of from a transparency standpoint right now.
Well, and the Law Foundation board guy, Massey, did say, you know, like, we did this all wrong. Like, you know, we made mistakes and we regret it and we won't do it again.
So what exactly did he acknowledge was a mistake?
Well, the mistake is that they had money going straight from the foundation. This is similar to CPR. They had money going straight from the foundation to the recipients of the money, the employees, the faculty. And so there's no way actually, so for example, for us to track that money, right? It becomes, it's not a public transaction.
Because
so,
the foundations are not public.
Right.
I want to clarify what I said about powers. I'm now looking at an article that was written by some Yahoo named Reeve Hamilton. And here's what it says. Powers himself never received a forgivable loan, but he did receive a significant deferred compensation package from the foundation. So in some way, Powers did receive some compensation by way of this foundation. Now, do you know if not just the forgivable loans, but any...
Well, it's also, you know...
Any deferred compensation? Is the foundation now going to just stop doing everything to augment salaries?
No, not at all. But what they're going to do... Because, I mean, it's... Yeah, when we talk about this, the idea of the foundation giving money to support salaries is not nefarious or absurd.
Well, the reality is the Longhorn Foundation, which is over the athletics department, has been... Has been involved in the compensation structures of coaches and other employees of the athletic department, I believe, for some...
And this is how...
For some time.
This is how lots of entities work. You have a foundation that raises money for you, and then there is a huge donor. They give about $6 to $7 million a year.
And so, and what they're trying to do is keep competitive with the private sector or with other institutions.
Right.
And if the budgets don't permit them to match salaries, they can find money outside of the conventional salary structure.
But now, instead of say I'm the foundation and Emily is a faculty member of the law school, instead of me giving money directly to Emily from now on going forward, I will route all money for Emily's salary supplement through you, her boss, so that when you give it to her, it'll be tracked.
It'll be a Tribune payment.
Now,
you are the university in this case.
One thing that came up at this hearing was that, you know, one of the reasons they said that they had screwed up was because, you know, they said we're a public university. So I'm assuming this happens probably all the time at private universities, and there's just no way to track it.
Right. But I mean, but private universities can do what they
want. But there's no taxpayer dollars. Right.
Yeah. No, I mean, so it's sort of nuanced, you know, sort of what was wrong and. But this fight could also extend to, you know, they're looking into, the Regents are looking into the relationship between the Texas X's and the University of Texas.
And the 12th Man Foundation and A&M.
Right. Mm-hmm. And there's some questions about, you know, those, the University of Texas and Texas A&M can't lobby because they're state organizations, but these organizations.
But the alumni get
advocates,
activated, right? Yeah, exactly.
And so,
advocates.
Like, the lines of demarcation about who's responsible for what and who's communicating to who, and those will all probably come up in the near future. But a lot of this fight will be around this transparency and foundation stuff as we move forward. And it'll be, you know, what exactly is going to go on the joint committee that's oversight on higher education excellence, governance, and et cetera, transparency, that sort of remains to be seen. But the real fight right now is really in this House Select Committee, which was set up early on. Mm-hmm.
Well, I just want to go ahead and come clean and say that in December I received a John Ailey rain gauge from KUT. So... You know, from our foundation.
Well, this will be Ben's last podcast.
Is it better than John Ailey?
No comment.
Ring.
Well, on that note.
Yeah.
Sorry, John Ailey.
That's the end of our KUT relationship.
Good thing John Ailey already did an intro for us.
He did?
That's right. Oh, yeah. It was
did he? Was it great?
Was it about rain or crepe myrtle trees?
Yes. And I should say, if you have questions or comments about any of the things that Ben said, you can email tribcast@texastribune.org. And once again, if you want a free audiobook and a 30-day free trial to audible.com, so you can listen to Larry Wright's opus on Scientology, you can go to audibletrial.com/tribcast and sign up. On behalf of Evan, Emily, Ben, Todd, and thanks to Shiny Ribs for the music, this is Reeve. Thanks for listening. Texas talking. Texas talking. Texas talking. Texas talking about Texas talking, baby.
You know, honestly, you were, from every estimation that I got, you were a bad girl.